Welcome back to the Move Podcast. We got a couple of races to cover for you today. I'm JB Hager, and I'll just be lobbing questions at these two guys who know a lot about bike racing. Spencer Martin, who you might know from Beyond the Peloton newsletter and podcast, and Johan Bernil, who you know from racing and director in thirteen Grand Tour wins as a director. We'll get into both these races, Catalunya, the Tour of Catalunya, and Gent-Wevelgem in just a second. Before we do that, let's check in with Lance with a couple of messages from our partners.
Today's show brought to you by Ventum as well. Now, gee, this is special. You and me are back riding the same bikes.
I know, man. I'm excited.
I got the man converted.
We spend our
whole lives riding the same bike. What are we? Well, except for a couple of those years, but we don't want to talk about those. But how's it been? How's the jump to Ventum?
I love it. I did a gravel race with my son last weekend on the GS1, and what a great fun ride! I mean, it's just really handles the dirt really well. Super compliant, yet very stiff, like stiff enough to where you feel the bike move when you need it to move.
Yeah, I get a lot of questions about both my NS1 and my GS1. The GS1 is just you want a rocket ship of a gravel bike, don't look any further.
I'm excited to take that NS1 on the cobbles in Flanders, which Johan and I will talk about later.
Well, exactly. We're going to talk about it right now. So we have Ventum is offering a special giveaway. So George, you're taking a crew of folks over to the Tour of Flanders. It's going to be you and Liz and Johan. You've got all the special VIP treatment that you guys always get. I don't know anything about that stuff, but you guys are going to be totally taken care of. We got a whole, I guess, from what you told me a minute ago, the damn thing sold out in like half a second. We got a waiting list, but Ventum will be there in full force. They're also giving away a nice little package here. Sign up. Go over to wedo.team. Click the Flanders giveaway tab. It takes 1 minute. The last day to enter is April the 2nd. Everybody who signs up in the drawing for a Ventum NS1, you're also eligible for prizes from Roca, Element, Fidlock, Manscaped, Montcush, The Feed, and Huckberry. All you got to do is head on over to ventumracing.com/themove. Use the code WEDO, W-E-D-O. Hello, I'm the one who invented the brand. W-E-D-U. At ventumracing.com/themove, that gets you 10% off. Today's show also brought to you by HVMN. We talk about it all the time. This is the go-to ketone for this Peloton and certainly for this show. It is a game changer, whether you're looking for recovery or performance or mental clarity, right? This is the crazy thing for me. And I know, JB, you've touched on this a lot and are a firm believer, whether we call it COVID brain or just, a hangover from South by Southwest. Ketone IQ and HVMN have changed the game. It actually crosses the blood-brain barrier, which is very hard to do for all you people that know about those things. Again, 60% of the Peloton is using it. Total game changer. Head on over to HVMN.com. Use the promo code THEMOVE. That gets you 20% off. HVMN.com. Promo code THEMOVE.
All right, let's start with Tour of Catalunya. It was quite a show among two riders. Again, a recurring theme so far this season where, one, two, maybe three are just so far above the rest of the field. They're just on another level. And that's what we got with the Primoz Roglic and Remco Evenepoel show. 10 seconds apart after a week of racing and just head-to-head, day by day. So let's jump right into that and talk about that battle, which Roglic, just an animal. He's just an animal. The first thing that comes to mind for me is this guy just continues to overcome adversity. Injuries started late in racing, and he's just got this killer mentality.
Yeah, it's incredible to see. We were all already in awe for his comeback after dropping out last September in the Vuelta with that crash and injury. He added Tirreno last minute to his program, and didn't really start, in my opinion, with super high ambitions. Hence the unshaven legs in Tirreno, and he ended up winning Tirreno with three stages. Catalunya is, was a, you know, different game also. I mean, it was very, very similar to what we saw in Paris-Nice with the two big favorites for the Tour de France, Vingegaard and Pogacar. This is Remco Evenepoel and Roglic, in theory, the two big favorites for the Giro. And yeah, we saw the same thing. You know, Roglic started straight away by winning stage one in a bunch sprint. Given, I mean, it was a slight uphill finish, but still, it was a bunch sprint. And even better than that, not just Roglic winning that race, but Remco finishing second in that bunch sprint. So that was kind of the way, okay, this is the way it's going to go this week, guys. It's going to be Roglic and Remco. You know, if they start to win bunch sprints, then what else? You know, what else is there? And that's what we saw. I mean, every day was a battle.
Now, I know you guys did not do an outcomes for Catalunya, you know, the predictions, but did you have in your minds, both of you, who would be better of these two, Roglic or Evenepoel, prior to the
Spencer,
race?
What do you think?
Yeah, so I bet on Roglic after that stage one win. I thought, oh, this is going to be a Roglic cakewalk. He was still an underdog. That's like a funny thing about this season. Roglic has been a betting underdog in all these races, even though this is what he does, win these races. But then, you know, stage three rolls around and Evenepoel wins that stage. And I started to get a little concerned, like, ooh, I really thought I got the bet wrong. I thought, oh, Evenepoel's a stronger rider. Roglic is good, but he just realistically, if Evenepoel's going to have a kick at the end of races, this isn't doable. So I originally thought Roglic, and then I lost faith and then regained faith at the end of the race. But I was surprised, actually, that Roglic was able to win this.
Me too, because I mean, even if he won stage one, I mean, it's already a week ago, but Evenepoel was far back. He was like 10th position and then finished second finally. But that was basically a proof that Evenepoel was in and is in great shape. And personally, I think in terms of pure condition and strength, I would say maybe Evenepoel was a bit stronger than Roglic, but he just races completely differently. And Roglic has this dialed down to the detail, you know, I mean, whenever he can, he just follows. He did not have the power or the strength to attack at any point. But just, I mean, at the end of stage five, he did, because he won that stage and took some seconds on Remco. But I personally think Remco was the strongest of the two, but he didn't win. He was beaten by Mr. Consistency and Mr. Meticulous, you know, grinding the seconds, bonus seconds, wherever they are. And he's a master at that. So yeah, I mean, hats off to him. You know, I mean, he.
Are you saying he's a smarter racer or more patient or more?
I think he's. I think he's more zen than Remco. He is. You know, listen, he already has won a lot of races. Remco also, but Remco still has this incredible, you know, adrenaline and really hunger. And makes mistakes. I think Remco makes mistakes still. And especially when you race against a guy like Roglic and you make mistakes, he is going to make you pay for it. And that's what happens. That's what happened here in Catalunya.
Well, I can run through each stage winner. And then I think he made a huge mistake on stage five, which is where the race was decided. Like Johan said, Roglic wins stage one. Kind of, it seemed like every stage was an uphill sprint here. Great, great course design. No complaints. Stage two was a summit finish. Remco let it out from like 2K to go. Seemed not to really mind that there was people on his wheel. I thought he went through the last corner just way too wide, left it wide open inside. Giulio Ciccone comes in, wins the sprint. Roglic gets second, which is key because he picks up more bonus seconds. Remco gets third. Great result for Trek and Ciccone. Third uphill finish, Remco finally wins this one. And I'm thinking at the time, like, wow, like if he can win uphill sprints, this guy's unstoppable. Stage four was a sprint. Caden Groves wins from Alpecin. Stage five, Roglic wins really difficult uphill summit finish, like 11% average in the final K. Caden Groves wins stage six. We'll talk about that. That was incredible. And then Remco won today, stage seven. But if we jump back to stage five, Remco opened up like a massive explosive sprint with 300 meters to go on an 11% finish.
Well, I think
that was crazy.
Spencer, I think we have to go back further than 300 meters. Let's go back 3-4 kilometers where Remco starts to, and he did the same on stage three. He attacks with, I don't remember exactly, but 3-4K to go. And then basically it's the two of them. And whenever they slow down, a third one comes back. Generally, it was either Ciccone or João Almeida. But anyway, whenever Remco decided to go, then it was the two of them. Remco and Roglic could not do anything else but follow. And I think if you go back to stage three, Remco really was, it's the first time that I really see a good Roglic being beaten that way. You know, like a hard climb, uphill finish at the end, and he really could not follow the wheel. You know, it's not just being beaten. He was dropped a little bit, and Remco made a little mistake there by celebrating too early.
Yeah, he sat up,
losing
and
one
celebrated.
Or 2 seconds. Otherwise, he would have been in the lead. So a little mistake there. Is it unexperienced? Is it not being experienced, or is it being too excited to win? But you know, it wouldn't have changed because finally, Roglic won with 10 seconds in the end. But Remco basically did a lead out in those two stages with 3-4K to go. And then, you know, he started to go. Roglic followed whenever he, you know, and then Remco went again. And then, especially on stage five, as you say, I calculated from the moment he goes, really, like, he says, okay, this is my effort to the line. It was 42 seconds of sprinting. There's no way you can keep that, not against a guy like Roglic. And so finally, Remco ran out of legs and had to sit down. And in 50 meters, in the last 50 meters, he lost 6 seconds in 50 meters. That's where the race was won by Roglic, right?
Yeah, and then Roglic wins the GC by 6 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, if he doesn't, I don't know if he's getting information from the team car, or if it's just racing on instinct, but if he just waits, even just marks Roglic, finishes second on the stage, he probably wins the overall of this race. I mean, that was a huge mistake to go that early.
Well, I don't know about that, Spencer, because, you know, if you look at today's stage, Roglic didn't sprint. Basically, they made a deal. Once they were together, the both of them, they definitely made an agreement and said, okay, you know, you win the stage. I've been on your wheel for the last 2 days. So hats off to Roglic. You know, that's really a gentleman's gesture to say, okay, I'm winning this bike race. You win the stage. We're all happy. Smart move. You know, they're going to meet each other for the next, in a month, during 3 weeks in the Giro. So not that Remco will have that in mind. He will attack whenever he can. He won't say, oh, you know, thank you for the win. You let me win there, and I'm not going to attack you now. No. As soon as the Giro starts, it's a different race again. But I think Remco is still racing too much on adrenaline.
He appeared to me like he was just frustrated and angry. He was constantly checking Roglic is right there.
Yeah,
and you could just see it in his face that he just was frustration is probably
that was yesterday. JB, was a stage where, you know, normally you would never expect something like that from the two guys in GC. It was you know, supposed to be a bunch sprint. It was a reduced bunch sprint in the end, but just because both of those guys, Roglic and Evenepoel, decided that it was going to be a bunch sprint, because they, you know, Roglic didn't collaborate and he shouldn't. I mean, it was his right to not collaborate because he was in the lead. Remco needed the bonus seconds. And, you know, if you're in the lead, you follow the second one, right?
And what did you make of that, Jan? So he attacks. He probably should have sat up as soon as he realized Roglic wasn't going to work. He kept going. I thought maybe wasted energy he could have used today, but he's screaming at Roglic to come through. Clearly it's in his head.
Yeah.
Like, is that like performative? Is he just trying to shame Roglic into working, or does he really expect him to work?
Well, I mean, I don't know. You know, he was obviously frustrated. They're two completely different characters, right? Remco is pure adrenaline. When he attacks, and when something doesn't go his way, it's not the first time we see Remco's being, you know, not happy and showing it clearly. There's a lot of other times I'm sure that Roglic wasn't happy in races and we never saw it. You know, he just keeps going and just executes what he does best, you know, either attacking or following the best guy and then beating them at the finish.
What would you say to Remco post-race at the dinner table?
Well,
in with the Giro in mind, what would you say to him to get the results he wants?
You know what? I don't know. I mean, everybody's different. In my opinion, Remco is a rider. He will listen to advice, but he will not automatically, you know, take it on board and say, okay, I'm going to do this. He will listen to it and then he's going to decide himself, okay, whether I do it. And then in the race, he forgets, you know, I mean, if you look at Roglic, how he won this Tour of Catalonia, he won this in the Miguel Indurain way, right? Always being there, you know, going hard when it matters. And then at the end, giving the stage away. Remco, on the other hand, raced completely differently. Physically, even if you're stronger, you have to be a lot stronger than Roglic to drop him. And then on top of that, if emotionally you spend energy over 3 weeks, it's going to cost him. You know, he needs to start to, you know, be more calculating and just assume. You know, that if you're, it's, I mean, he knows that everybody thinks he's the best, right? I mean, I think he is going to be the best at some point in the next few years. I mean, he's the best in the world since when he was 16, 17 years old. So then you have to expect that, you know, people are not just going to ride with you and collaborate with you just because you're asking, you know, they're only going to do it if they think that either they can benefit from it or if they can beat you in the sprint, because dropping him is very difficult. So why would you? Right. And that's something that I think he needs to, I mean, it must be incredibly frustrating though. You know, if you're, that's one of the disadvantages of being so good, you know, I mean, if you're that good, you know, who's going to help you? Who's going to ride with you? You know, if I'm a rider and I can follow a guy like Evenepoel, I'm going to try to, because I'm going to expect him to drop me after every corner. So why would you collaborate, right?
Yeah. And if Roglic works with him on stage six, holds off the sprinters, Evenepoel wins the stage, gets the time bonuses, like Roglic should be fired right there. Like, what are you doing, man? This is the dumbest decision ever. So, I mean, just it never was going to happen. Evenepoel was also asking on stage three, which, you know, I thought he was flicking his elbow a little too much, maybe wasting a little bit too much energy. But in that case, like, you know, it doesn't hurt to ask him to come through. Maybe he will, he shouldn't, but maybe he will. But stage six, I thought, like, what type of advice is he get? Is the team talking to him during this?
I don't think he listens to those things. I mean, you know, I mean, you try, but, and even, I mean, that decision, I mean, even without instructions from the car, from Jumbo, Roglic knows damn well what he needs to do, but I can guarantee you the instructions from the team car in Jumbo were, you do not work together, you know, just stay on his wheel, let him spend that energy. And, you know, we don't, they wanted the bonus seconds to be gone, right? But there you see how much of a fighter a guy like Evenepoel is, because he rode, I don't know, 20-25K with Roglic on the wheel. Then he still wins that bonification against Roglic, just like 15K before the finish or something. And then he still sprints and he gets fifth. I mean, he was really trying to get bonification. He was trying to get bonification, like being second or first, second or third in the stage, and gets fifth. I mean, the risk was there, you know, the risk was there that he could take the bonification, and that was completely against the interest of Roglic and Jumbo-Visma.
We'll get to the amazing effort by Caden Groves in a second, and also some unreal statistics on Roglic with 1 week tours. But Johan, this is again a testament to Remco's power. You've heard or read or maybe got some inside intel that he's still a bit heavier than where he should be.
Well, you know, yeah, I mean, I've heard that I don't believe that, but I've heard someone told me he's 4 kilos heavier than the skinniest he has been in the Tour of Spain. I mean, he was really skinny in the Tour of Spain. That's true. And now he looks, I mean, he looks fit, of course, and skinny, but to me, 4 kilos is a lot. I mean, if he's 4 kilos heavier and he can get to his Vuelta weight in the Giro, then it's game over. It's like, okay, don't even try anybody else, because he was already going really, really, really hard. I mean, but not just Remco, you know, let's say the first 10 of every stage race uphill finishes, they almost all beat the existing records nowadays. So here again, you know, on stage 3 and on stage 5, the records were broken by a lot, especially on stage 5, by a lot. And on stage 2 also, by the way. But so you know, if you can do that with 4 kilos weight, that's, you know, you're really, really strong. I don't think it's 4, but maybe 1-2 kilos. He definitely is not at his race weight. That I know. So he's still going to improve. We'll see. You know, I mean, it's promising for the Giro to see these two guys. I mean, as for now, I haven't seen anybody else who would even be close to them in the Giro. But then again, you know, it's 3 weeks. A lot of things can happen, and you know, these guys are already. And Remco did his first stage race was Argentina. He kind of had a bad experience there at altitude, but then he won the Tour of UAE. Now is second in Catalonia, and Roglic wins Tirreno and wins Catalonia. So they're on the top of their game, and they still need to improve for the Giro. So I can't see anybody. It's going to be another race, you know, to be the best of the rest.
Yeah, I mean, there's good riders in this race, and they made them look like scrubs. I mean, whenever Evenepoel or Roglic raised the pace, it was like just shed everybody off the back. Yeah. Do we want to talk a second about UAE? Like, like what exactly was going on here with this team where it felt like they were, not only did they not race well together, they raced against each other. Like on stage 2, Almeida has a mechanical, it looked like he just ran out of batteries or something. His front derailleur wouldn't work. Gets a new bike, almost catches back on. Evenepoel goes, he's dropped. Adam Yates, who loses 10 minutes on the first stage, so he's out of the GC, is then driving the group away from his teammate, who's still in the GC, completely oblivious. No one drops back to help Almeida. And then today on stage 7, and this is just like a little sample platter of the dysfunction at UAE this week. Today, Marc Soler jumps and goes with Evenepoel and Roglic, which was actually, I was glad he did, because Soler's a good rider. It let us see how good Roglic and Evenepoel were, because he was like physically jerking his bike just to stay in the wheel of Evenepoel, which is wild. But, you know, he was going for third on the GC, which his teammate, Joao Almeida, had. And then there was times during that last lap where Soler was dropped from the front group, but still off the peloton, and Almeida was chasing his own teammate to try to retain his own third place. This feels like it's not like the toxicity that they had last year at Catalunya, I believe, where Juan Ayuso and Joao Almeida were getting into it, or maybe it was one of these.
It was the Vuelta.
The Vuelta. And it just doesn't feel like any of that's been taken care of, and we're still going to see dysfunction at that team.
To me, it seems that there's two teams in UAE. There's one team which works perfectly whenever Tadej Pogacar's racing, because he's the clear leader and everybody's around him and knows their job. And then there's the freelance team. You know, but whenever Pogacar is not racing, and they have certain guys who are very close, like Adam Yates, Almeida, Marc Soler, to name these three, they're close to each other in terms of fitness. And you can argue, third was the best possible anyway, right? So they were always going to get third. So here, I don't know if the instructions from the team were, okay, guys, whoever is the strongest between Soler and Almeida gets third, you know, and Soler is in great shape. You know, I mean, he did some really incredible stages here. He wanted to be on the podium. He's Catalan. So it's his home race. So I don't know if the team direction says, hey guys, you guys figure it out as long as we're on the podium. Then on the other hand, you have to say also, what I've seen is that, whenever Pogacar's not there, they're always with multiple guys, you know, like once again here, they're third and fourth, you know, they're scoring points. Their goal is to be number one team in the world at the end of this season. And this keeps adding up, right? I agree. It looks really unprofessional, but points wise, it's super, super efficient because they're up there.
Yeah. Does it? Yeah. And it does. It is kind of like, oh, dad's gone. Like, and then like everyone's misbehaving. But there was even times where Pogacar was like yelling at the team car for water and stuff for the tour. So is he just so good that when he's there, it appears to be back on track, and that it's just not a buttoned up organization. It feels like this is going to be relevant again. Like this is like Chekhov's gun, Chekhov's dysfunctional team. When we get into the depths of the tour and things aren't going well, like, are we going to see Adam Yates just like leave the race? Like there, you know, if you remember the 2021 tour where Geraint Thomas wanted to leave the race because he wanted to focus on the Olympics, and Ineos had to tell him, no, you're going to stay and support Carapaz, and didn't go that well. Like I'm just getting vibes like that from this UAE team.
Mm-hmm. There's definitely something there. You know, it's two teams when Tadej Pogacar is in the race and not. And you know, I mean, listen, Almeida, Adam Yates, Marc Soler, maybe that's also the deal, you know, like, hey guys, whenever we need you guys, you need to be at the service of Pogacar, but when he's not racing, you're free to try and get a good result. I mean, that's, you have to find a balance between keeping the rider's ambitions alive and being efficient. And I don't know, man. I mean, maybe we are concluding something completely different. Maybe that's what they, I mean, today was really, really amazing. If you see Marc Soler, they're like fighting for his life to get to the finish in third position, and João Almeida attacking behind him. That was, yeah. I mean, and it's not like he attacked and went away on his own. He was attacking and dragging everybody with him.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm imagining the pre-race speech on the bus, you know, okay, Pogacar's not here. You guys go do whatever you want. we are going to talk about Caden Groves, who picked up two sprint wins, but something very interesting about Roglic. He is his ability with 1 week tours. Break down his palmaris on that.
Yeah. So, you know, a part of the three grand tours, you know, this is the Giro, the Tour and the Vuelta, 3 week stage races. There's another list. I mean, within cycling, they call it the seven big ones, which are like the main, most prestigious 1 week races, right? So it's Paris-Nice, Tirreno Adriatico, Tour of Catalunya, Tour of the Basque Country, Tour of Romandy, and then Dauphiné and Tour of Switzerland. Those are like the seven most prestigious 1 week races. And with this victory now, in Catalunya, Roglic has now won six out of seven of these 1 week stage races. He only lacks Tour of Switzerland, which, I mean, I don't know if after the Giro maybe he could do the Tour of Switzerland and try to win that. But that's just a proof of how good a rider he is. You know, I mean, he's just in 1 week stage races where, you know, even if there's a short time trial or even a longer time trial, you know, doesn't really matter. He can win all those races. I don't have the stats on who has done it before. There's a few who've done it before, but not many, not many. I would want to say for sure Eddy Merckx has done it. Maybe not. I mean, I don't know. Maybe not. But yeah, it's quite impressive, you know, to and then add to that, you know, three times the Vuelta, second in the Tour and third in the Giro. That's no, it's not a bad, not a bad list to retire with, you know?
All right. I want to ask you one more Roglic question. Okay. And I know if you look at the calendar, you look on paper, this question makes no sense. But watching Roglic's ability, and if he doesn't have any incidents in 3 week tours, is he a better option for Jumbo-Visma for Tour de France? I know it's not on his calendar, but is he a better option than Vingegaard right now?
I would say no. I think he's a good option for Jumbo-Visma to do the Tour if they race together. If Vingegaard and Roglic race together against Pogacar, which...
As co-leaders?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I would definitely try to do that. But, you know, I think in my... Roglic, in my opinion, has seen that Pogacar is super strong and he doesn't really see where he can beat him. Jonas Vingegaard was a lot stronger than him last year in the Tour. So now, I mean, he wants to try to win the Giro, you know? I can understand that. And it's obviously great for Jumbo-Visma also, but really, I mean, if you really want to go for the Tour and try to be as strong as possible, I would do Jonas Vingegaard and Roglic together against Pogacar. That would be, I mean, listen, last year it worked and Roglic was not even super strong. And he was crucial in that strategy to beat Pogacar that one day in the Alps. So imagine if Roglic is really super in top shape and doesn't have any problems and has no crashes.
And what do you think, Spencer? Yeah, I guess there's two paths to this. Let's say he crashes out first week of the Giro. You know, not impossible. That would actually be ideal for his Tour preparation. Then he like rests and recover the Tour. Also, he could win the Giro. I don't think we're going to see someone win the Giro and win the Tour.
No.
I don't think that's going to happen. And 98 was a special year. A lot of special stuff going on with Pantani that year. But... But we did see, I don't know if like this kind of just got glossed over. Tom Dumoulin, I think that was 2018, gets second at the Giro and then got second at the Tour. I mean, so he proved you can do two strong rides at those races. Like if Roglic wins that Giro, you know, takes a lot of pressure off his shoulder. He's going to that Tour, like with no expectations of being the leader. He's there just as like a plan B. I think that could be really good for Jumbo. And I think you could see Roglic getting a pretty good result, you know, working in tandem with Jonas like he did last year.
Yeah. Well, maybe he wants to go for the Giro and then try to win the Vuelta, you know? He's already shown he can win the Vuelta. If he would win the Vuelta a fourth time, that would be equaling the record of Roberto Heras. So, I mean, listen, Jumbo-Visma, they have such a strong team that to be able to say, hey, you know what, Primoz, we don't really need you in July. Just fine. Wow, you know, yeah, right. Just go for the Giro and then take it easy and then show up in September again. Right. That's something.
I do think Primoz, sorry, JB, I think he gets in Pogacar's head a little bit, which is almost like his superpower, where just because they're Slovenian Pogacar still sees him as a rival. Like, he never should have even been responding to those attacks on that difficult day at the Tour last year. But because it's Roglic, Pogacar, it almost like Jedi mind tricks him into following moves he shouldn't.
Yeah, that was definitely that, you know, Pogacar, I mean, I'm not going to say he should have known, because of course, you know, they're not going to reveal their strengths. But it was clear last year that Roglic did have some problems after his crash in, on the cobblestones, the cobblestone race, the cobblestone stage, and that he was, you know, he was not going to be, the leader of the team, but yet Pogacar went with the same effort after Roglic, then after Vingegaard, just before the Galibier, and that's ultimately what broke him.
One last thing from Catalonia, and then we'll move on to Gent-Wevelgem, is Johan pointed out to us that something he's like probably never seen before that Caden Groves executed to win one of those sprints. Just did nearly the impossible. If anybody listening or watching us didn't see what happened, break that one down.
Yeah, so stage six. I mean, it was not a pure bunch sprint, right? But some of the sprinters really tried everything they could to stay in the first group and make it to the finish. Caden Groves being one of them, and being, not. I'm not going to say the clear favorite because Brian Cockart was there. There was, you know, other sprinters there. But yeah, I mean, 3.8 kilometers before the finish, Caden Groves apparently had a slow flat, and the cars were not there because he got the instructions from the team car to switch bikes with one of his teammates, and then made it back with another teammate and won the bunch sprint on the bicycle of one of his teammates, which was not even his size. So, I mean, to be able to do that, that's
the effort to get back in the race and to still execute a sprint.
Okay. One thing I have to say, the circumstances were ideal because it was a smaller group. So obviously not complete teams to lead it out. And also it was headwind. So it was a slow run in to the finish. But still, you know, having to change bikes, making that effort, going from last position, maybe there were 45, 50 guys left, to the front, and then win the sprint. But all of that on a bike which is not yours, I mean, I cannot imagine it. That's just, that's crazy. But that was really, really impressive. And then I was really surprised to see his race interview after the race that, The team director said I had to switch bikes because they couldn't get to me, and I did it, and yeah, I won. I mean, you just did something unbelievable. I mean, it's like I've never seen something like this.
I'm gonna go back and watch that again. I wasn't paying that much attention.
Just watch the last 5K. It's quite impressive.
Wow.
That's a very Australian mentality to have. Oh yeah. It's crazy adversity. It wasn't that big of a deal. One more thing about this race, did you guys realize Richard Carapaz was here? I mean, complete gotten a few breakaways, completely invisible in the GC. This is coming after the Vuelta last year, where he was supposed to be a GC rider and kind of washed out and had a few great stage wins. But are we seeing Carapaz go from a GC contender, what I thought was one of the best GC contenders in the sport, to a stage hunter?
No, I don't think so. Let's not forget, you know, we always judge riders based on their last performances, right? So he did have a very disappointing, I mean, not a very disappointing, I mean, I think he won three stages, right? In the Vuelta.
Yeah, it was kind of this weird Vuelta where, how could you not say that's great, but then that's probably not what he went there for.
Yeah, he won three stages in the mountains jersey, but you know, he was not in GC. But let's not forget, you know, he was second in the Giro last year. You know, and just because of one stage on the Passo Fedaya, I think, La Marmolada, there he lost it. But, you know, he was one of the big favorites, was second. He already won the Tour. Won the Giro, was third in the Tour, was second in the Vuelta, second in the Giro. You know, I mean, he's a stage racer. And this year, He started the season slower because he's focusing on the tour. So I think that was kind of expected. But, you know, for sure, listen, I mean, it's Carapaz is a great rider, but he's not at the level of those top riders. He's not at the level of Evenepoel and Pogacar and Vingegaard and Roglic. But he is, in certain big tours, he's a candidate for the podium. I mean, he was third in 2021, right?
Yep. He was fantastic. He was staying with Pogacar and Vingegaard on those uphill finishes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he's at a team now with like a lot of tour wins, so I'm sure there's no worries there.
Well, you know, at the end, I mean, he's going to be fine. I mean, I think once come the tour, I think Carapaz is going to be ready. He's a racer. He goes, I mean, he knows that when the race is really going on, that there's two or three riders who are above his level, but he's going to take advantage of certain circumstances and give it a try. And he will want to be on the podium. I mean, if he could be on the podium again in the tour, which would mean in his case, best case scenario, third, I think for him and in his country and in Latin America, that's like a victory.
Yeah, and that's huge for his team too. So yeah, maybe he has it under control, but I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, one last thing about Catalunya. Now that we're speaking about Latin Americans, another setback for Egan Bernal. You know, Egan Bernal started here again after having to pull out because of a crash in Tour of San Juan, Argentina. Started here. It was clear that he had, you know, he has a delay in his physical fitness, and started with that in mind, but had another crash on stage six and had to pull out again. So another setback, which starts to be, you know, I'm not going to say worrying, but you know, it's definitely not ideal. So you know, the way. These guys are evolving and improving every year a little bit, 1%, 1.5%. Starts to be a little bit of a concern for Egan Bernal if he can get back up there with Pogacar, with Vingegaard, with Remco.
I'm sure you guys are going to go a little deeper on that on La Movida tomorrow, yeah?
For sure, yeah. For sure, yeah.
We'll jump into Gent-Wevelgem in a second, but I do want to just take a minute and tell you about a new product from a sponsor of ours and a partner of ours that we've had for some time. I just want to take a second here and tell you about some big news coming from our friends at Manscaped. Big news on two fronts. They have the brand new Weed Whacker 2.0. All right. That's all your below the waist needs. Above the waist, they have just come out with this, the Beard Hedger Pro Kit. All right. So if you want to take care of that beard, leave it looking nice. I'll be able to tell you a lot more about it on a future show. I believe it's showing up at my house today. And as you can see, if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, not rocking the beard right now, but the first few seasons of the move, I did. So now having a product like this, the Beard Hedger Pro, really, really looking forward to it. Might bring it back. Might just bring it back here. And that also in that kit includes a beard shampoo and conditioner, beard oil, and beard balm to take care of moisturizing. So if you want to get this as a gift for yourself or a friend, 20% off and free shipping when you use our code. Again, 20% off. Use the code THEMOVE at manscaped.com. One more time, 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com. Use our code THEMOVE. All right. Gent-Wevelgem, the Yumbo show. That was amazing. Let's go right to the finish and then work around some other parts. Wout van Aert and Laporte, they just get away from everybody and go to the finish arm in arm. Just absolutely amazing. I want to know your thoughts on Wout van Aert. It's gifting to his teammate the win. He was clearly stronger.
are your thoughts on that? That's a big race to just, even though he's won it before, I had to look that up. That is a very, very big race. I'd love your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I didn't really know what was going to happen until we finally saw that Wout pushed Laporte basically over the finish line. Say, okay, here you go. Listen, I think first of all, I think it's a decision of Wout van Aert himself,
not a team decision.
I mean, they for sure have talked about it, but listen, in that case, you say, okay, guys, listen, you know, you guys decide, right? I think it's amazing. First of all, it's amazing to have the luxury as a cyclist, as a champion, to you know, to be able to say, hey, we're here in Gent-Wevelgem, which, you know, certain riders, winning Gent-Wevelgem is the biggest accomplishment in their career, and he says, hey, here, you can win.
That's like the equivalent of going into a club with $100 bills and just because you have so much.
Hey, here you go.
So yeah, I mean, that was, but it's also a smart move, you know. Wout van Aert can ask anything to Laporte now. Anything.
That's what I was immediately thinking. I thought Laporte will bury himself in Flanders next Sunday.
Yeah. Well, not that he wouldn't do it anyway, but it's just that extra little bit of, you know, that extra 0.5%, you know. And Laporte, I mean, I have to say, Laporte is on an unbelievable level. I mean, he's stronger than last year. He was the second strongest rider in the race for sure. But you know, the first time the first when they went away with him and Van Aert on the Camelberg, he was, I'm not going to say comfortably, but he could follow Van Aert, and nobody else could. I mean, it was once again, you know, them on a certain level, and then, you know, both of those guys just riding away 2 minutes from the rest of the guys. That was just crazy. It's not like Laporte was just sitting on the wheel of Van Aert, right? He was, whenever Van Aert wanted to pull, he took a pull. So I think he deserved that, and it's a testimony to, you know, the winning mood in that team. And man, if they have no bad luck in Flanders, it's gonna be so difficult that a Jumbo rider doesn't win. You know, for now, there's been four cobbled classics. It started with Omloop and Nieuwsblad and Kuurne the day after, then E3 and now Gent-Wevelgem. All four cobbled classics were won by a Jumbo rider.
Wow.
Did you see, guys, Van Aert dropped Laporte on, I think it was the last pass of the Kimmelberg and waited for him.
Yeah, that was,
I've never seen that.
He had to do that. I mean, that was his insurance. You know, I mean, he was going to lose. I mean, and Laporte knew that he had to stay as close as possible to Van Aert. You know, they already had over a minute then, right? So if you look at Van Aert went, but he didn't go full, dropped Laporte, and Laporte went full and was not that far behind. But, you know, losing those 5 or 10 seconds compared to having a guy who can, it was still more than 30K to go and very windy. That was definitely the plan. And I have to say, Laporte did an amazing job there by not getting dropped further back than, because as soon as Van Aert was in the top, he was back there. He was back, you know, completely gassed for sure, but he was there.
What would, what Van Aert's chances have been percentage-wise without Laporte? Had he not waited up and tried to go on his own, 50%, 30%?
I'm going to say 100%.
Yeah, he would have had it.
he would have still had it.
He would have, the way he was riding today, even if Laporte is not there, he's going to the finish. If you see the dead bodies behind, and, you know, like, whenever there was two or three riders pulling really fast, you saw guys, I mean, one of the big, the big favorite of the race, Jasper Philipsen, getting dropped in the crosswinds on the flat, is a proof that, you know, listen, 260 kilometers in the rain and in the wind, it takes a lot out of you. And I mean, to me, it was remarkable to see the I mean, I'm not going to say they were fresh, right? But the relatively freshness of those two Jumbo-Visma riders, and then, you know, the how tired everybody was in the second group. That was the contrast was remarkable.
But should we talk about kind of the trap they laid for everyone and why it makes it hard for to imagine them getting beat? Which, of course, now that we've said it, they'll probably get beat at Flanders, but it seems overwhelming because they had Laporte and a few other riders in this really, really strong group off the front with between like 80 and 60 K to go that a lot like Van Aert was sitting at the back of that peloton, like just getting stuff from the car, relaxing. I think it was Soudal. It was hard to kind of identify everyone with the rain jackets on. I think it was Soudal Quickstep working on the front because they had
Soudal,
missed that move.
Soudal, but they ran out of guys. And luckily for Soudal, they got Groupama FDG had missed the move. And so, you know, it was dark blue jerseys. You know, Soudal and FDG. But I think personally, that was actually, you know, obviously it's the tactic to be in front and put the pressure on other teams. But that was a bigger risk to not win the race for Jumbo-Visma, to have those two. Because, I mean, they did have Olaf Kooi in front, super fast guy.
Yeah.
It was. I mean, if you look it on paper, it's a great situation, but still, you know, I mean, there was other guys there. There was Mohoric, there was Pedersen. There were strong riders, so there was not a guarantee to win. But they put the pressure on, and basically everybody was run out of legs already before the second time up the Camelberg, and that's when Van Aert and Laporte went, and nobody had an answer. They were all done.
I guess we perceived it to be risky, but you know, since Laporte was in that move, they clearly know that like they must have had confidence in him that Pedersen is there, Mohorovic is there, but this guy's better than those guys. And probably he was, because the commentators on Eurosport were saying, oh, people just missed the move on the Kimmelberg. It's like, no one saw Van Aert going and thought, you know, I don't know about this. Like nobody they could have been the there. They would have been
nobody
there.
Missed their legs ran out of power. That's what that was. You know, nobody missed the move. They were just, you know, going to the front and riding away.
We're seeing a lot less of that this spring. They've not been crafty wins by just seizing an opportunity. It's the strongest that goes and everyone watches it, and there's nothing you can do about it. That's been happening all spring.
There are a few riders right now. There's, you know, like they're like 6-7 riders. I mean, I would even say maybe 5 that basically can win all the races, and wow. and everybody else is just okay. You know, we can win if something happens to you, but if not, see you at the finish.
You know, and the big advantage is
on the second or the third spot of the podium.
If you have 2 or 3 of those 6 on your team, like wow, like you're going to be hard to beat, which is the position Jumbo's in.
Exactly. I mean, you know, they have. It's. I mean, if you look at their team for Flanders, also because this was not their top team, you know, today. Van Baarle crashed 2 days ago or 3 days ago there in E3. So we'll see how he is. But they had like three or four guys, and then there were the other three were kind of normally they would not make the Tour of Flanders team. So it's even more scary.
You mentioned Mohoric. We saw him slide out near the end of the race on a roundabout, a wet roundabout. Did we get, and there were a lot of crashes early in this race. Did we get any injury reports that will have an effect on the rest of the spring season?
Kwiatkowski didn't look good at all. So he stayed on the ground. I don't know. I mean, maybe it looked like shoulder or collarbone. I'm not sure. And then Filippo Ganna crashed early and pulled out. So obviously that was, you know, he must have been hurt. But Gent-Wevelgem is that kind of race. You know, the stuff we didn't see on TV. It's along the coast. It's super, super windy. Crosswinds, very nervous. There's always big crashes, and you know, combine that with narrow roads. that's part of it. You know, this is, that's also one of the reasons, for example, why certain riders opt out of Gent-Wevelgem, to eliminate that risk, because they have bigger goals further down the road.
I mean, I was going to ask you about that. Like, why is Van Aert here? Like, is it better? Is he now better positioned for Flanders than Pogacar and Vanderpool, who maybe had a nice warm day riding their bike? I mean, I saw Van Aert there on the mini couch again after the race, waiting for the podium, and it looked cold, and they're in their clothes that, you know, I don't think they showered. So like, they're probably sweaty, cold on this couch. I did not seem like an ideal situation you'd want to be in ahead of the biggest race of your season.
Yeah.
Like, but is the move just not to do this race?
Listen, normally I think now the way the calendar is decided, I think it's perfectly valid to do it, because, you know, it's this weekend, and then you have the next week you have Flanders. A few years, like, I don't know, seven, eight years ago, I think they changed it. It was Flanders, and then midweek it was Gent-Wevelgem, and then the next Sunday was Paris-Roubaix. And those were, in theory, always the same riders who did it, right? So I think now with the week in between, it's okay. It's okay to do it. Let's also not forget that Van Aert started his season later than expected, right? He started in Tirreno, his first race. So, I mean, listen, you can't have a better training ride than today's effort for Van Aert. As long as he doesn't get a cold. I saw the last race in E3, they were also really cold at the podium. They were shaking. So that's to be seen, you know, if this doesn't have any consequences. But, you know, you can't plan for that. You know, you can't say, oh, you know, I'm not going to do Gent-Wevelgem, because, and you don't know what weather's going to be. So, I mean, they did a great show today. So I'm happy Van Aert did it. It was amazing to watch.
When you look at Jumbo, what happened with Primoz today, you know, and this, like, yeah, for a team, like, wow, what a day.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's exceptional. Yeah,
we've seen already several of those, right? Like the other day, Roglic won the stage, and Van Aert won E3 on the same day. But yeah, I mean, listen, these guys are just, it's Jumbo's a winning machine, right? They have the quality, and they have their big guys in shape. So, you know, I mean, it's incredible. It's incredible. I mean, in the pre-show, we talked about, you know, Jumbo Visma and where they are. But if you go back to the history of that team, lots of people don't realize that this team actually exists since 1984.
Oh, this will be good. both of you, yeah, who are walking encyclopedias, because, yeah, you know, they did mention that on the commentary. They go, you know, it dates back to Rabobank. And I was like, oh, okay. Cause that was a team I really enjoyed watching back, yeah, in the day. But there's, yeah, and then you always talk about how these Belgian teams are just changing the sponsor around. So you kind of,
yeah, but this
track.
is actually, of course, you know, but the structure, I'm not going to say since 1984, but 1984 was, there was a Dutch team called Quantum Holland, which was also a supermarket, by the way. Quantum Holland, which had riders like Jan Raas and Adrie van der Poel, Mathieu's dad. Really like a really top team, more focused on the classics. Then it changed into another supermarket, but a clothing supermarket called Super Confex, green jerseys. They had a bunch of success. Then after that, Super Confex stopped their sponsoring, and a beer brand, Buckler, alcohol-free beer, took over. They had that team that's still always the same team, same management, same directors, same riders. And then after that, still the same manager got WordPerfect as a sponsor.
Okay, that gives it context of a time.
WordPerfect, yeah.
Wow.
then WordPerfect, in the last year of their sponsor deal, they changed the name into Novell, which was also one of those IT. I mean, it was a product of WordPerfect, Novell. And then Novell stopped. So basically WordPerfect stopped and then started Rabobank. I was actually a member of Rabobank in the first 2 years of their existence. And then since then, I mean, Rabobank has been around for a long time, started in 96. And if I'm not mistaken, they probably pulled out in 2007, 2008. Maybe 2008.
2012.
Yeah. Oh, 2012.
They got stuck with the sponsorship. I think it was like kind of a legal dispute. They didn't want to be sponsoring the team, but they couldn't get out of the contract.
Yeah, well, then there was 1 year, at least 1 year, where Rabobank still paid the team, but there was no sponsor. And they called the team Blanco, white. Blanco is white in Spanish. So white. It was no brand, nothing. It was just Blanco. Wow. And then after that, they had two more years. I think they had two more years of sponsoring. So Blanco, then Belkin came in as a small sponsor, but they got the title because the team was basically paid for by Rabobank, not wanting to be on the jersey. Belkin, I don't know how long that lasts, 1 or 2 years probably. And then
it was 2 years. Yeah.
3 years. Yeah. And then it changed into Lotto Jumbo. Lotto was the national lottery, Lotto NL. Jumbo was a co-sponsor. And now, and then it changed into Jumbo Visma.
Wow.
So long, long history.
And it's hard to imagine now. I mean, sitting here, they've won four out of four Cowboy Classics. Primo's just won Catalunya. They stunk. I mean, at the end of Rabobank's tenure and then Blanco, Belkin, Lotto, like this was a bad team, like one of the worst teams in professional cycling. The press officer took over the team because no one wanted it. That was a good idea. Good move by him.
Well, he did a good job. He did a really good job.
And then if you think about those Lotto Jumbo years, Primoz, like they got this unknown Slovenian guy who was working in a grocery store and he kind of...
Well, no.
I know. That's at like one the point story he might have walked into a grocery store at a certain point.
Spencer, that's like the story. That's like the story. I mean, it's a great story. That's like the story that Jonas Vingegaard was working in a fish factory. Like he didn't work there long. It was like a few months, and it was part of like a mental therapy. You know, these guys were already good cyclists. I mean, Primoz Roglic was, I mean, we all know he was a ski jumper and got into cycling because of his accident, but he was on a Slovenian team, Adria Mobil, and he won a few 1 week stage races already, like second level, but 1 week stage races. And that's how he got into Lotto Jumbo and won a time trial in the Giro. That was like the first time we saw Primoz Roglic, but that's, I don't know, 10 years ago.
Yeah, it was. Well, I think his first year with the team was 2016. Oh, and then he not so long ago. Really started to get results in 2017. I think it was here. Hold on. Let me back check that. But he's kind of, 2016. And he would really kind of turn the team around. They were not a good team. And then they got Roglic. And then now, like, think of the embarrassment of riches they have just in the last 5 years. It's really impressive.
Yeah, I remember Roglic won a time trial in the Giro. And then I don't know if the same year or the year after, he won a stage in the Tour where he dropped Contador on the Galibier from a breakaway. And so that was, and that then he started to, you know, really after 2017 to focus on Grand Tours.
I think that was the year after. I think he won the Giro stage 2016, Tour stage 2017.
Yeah.
And then 17, he started rattling off these one week state race wins. But what's funny is he was the Remco of his time. It was like this robot, fast guy who had no race strategy whatsoever. So it's funny now to watch him winning races over Remco using tactics. Mm-hmm. Like he's come a long way in that time.
Ah, it's amazing. It's amazing. or a guy who was used to fly in the air with skis attached to his feet. It's not a bad, not a bad change.
You're right. I mean, Slovenia, it doesn't get a lot of credit for it. It is like, there's a great bike infrastructure, a lot of people on bikes. Like, I'm sure he was riding bikes before he started racing in 2014 or whatever.
Right. I mean, the story goes that until he was 20 or 21, he did not own a bike.
That's what they say. I mean, I would like to fact check.
There's a picture out there. If I find it, I'll send it in the group. There's a picture out there of Primoz Roglic doing a race on a mountain bike with normal tennis shoes, like no clipping pedals, and a Française de Jeu jersey, like looking like a complete Sunday recreational rider.
I think he's in a road race too, and he's passing people. It's wow. Crazy.
Well, we'll be back for Flanders, and of course you guys are going to do outcomes. I'm really looking forward to that outcomes, your predictions, and that, you know, even if you're not into sports betting, it's really cool to hear you guys break down what you think is going to go down. That being said, will you give us what does your gut tell you is for a winner at Flanders now?
I have to say Wout van Aert.
Okay.
I'm going to say Tadej Pogacar.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, listen, these guys are going to be there, but you know, until now, there's no cobbled classics that hasn't been won by Jumbo. Of course, when Van der Poel and Pogacar come in the game, it's a different race, but I don't know. Van Aert, and he would deserve it. You know, he would deserve to win the Tour of Flanders.
Well, something about Van Aert, I should have mentioned this during Gent-Wevelgem. He looked kind of off form. I thought at San Remo, just not his normal self. He obviously won E3. He was the weakest rider in that front group. That's not a huge knock, since those guys are amazing. Today, I thought he looked noticeably stronger than Friday, which is wild that he can make jumps like that.
He looked like he was on a training ride.
Yeah, like he looked back to his old peak Tour de France fitness.
I'm also a big believer in karma. I think the gift he gave today is going to come back to him in a good way.
The way Van Aert looked today in that kind of weather circumstances, that's you're like, you know, it's like when a rider is in top shape, you know, it's like the moment he gets out of his bed, the first step he makes, you know, or coming down the stairs, like it's not like it's like that's Van Aert right now. So
we'll catch outcomes. That's going to be a really, really good show. You need to be a season pass holder. Tons of other benefits to be a season pass holder. You get the member tee, you get to watch all of our pre-show, you get the happy hours, which we just did another fun one. You get all of those things. You get discounts and a lot of times you get the first crack at some new apparel when we do some short run one-off fun things. The members kind of snag those up first. So a lot of benefits to that. But Johan, Spencer, great show. Appreciate you guys. And
JB, sorry, outcomes. And then for Flanders, we will be broadcasting the podcast from Flanders, from Bruges. George and I will be there on site. And we will have a very special guest.
Very special guest.
Yeah.
Everyone knows who that guest is. I guarantee you. If you've paid any attention to cycling at all in the last 20 years, you know this name. So, yeah, we're really looking forward to that. So, anyway, thank you, guys.